some practical aspects. The training of thoughts and feelings, pursued in the way described in the chapters on preparation, enlightenment, and initiation, introduces into the soul and spirit the same organic symmetry with which nature has constructed the physical body. Before this development, soul and spirit are undifferentiated masses. The clairvoyant perceives them as interlacing, rotating, cloud-like spirals, dully glimmering in reddish-brown or reddish-yellow tones. After this training, they begin to assume a brilliant yellowish-green or greenish-blue color and show a regular structure. This inner regularity, leading to higher knowledge, is attained when the student introduces into his thoughts and feelings the same orderly system with which nature has endowed his bodily organs that enable him to see, hear, digest, breathe, speak. Gradually he learns to breathe and see with his soul, to speak and hear with the spirit. In the following pages, some practical aspects of the higher education of soul and spirit will be treated in greater detail. They are such that anyone who can put them into practice regardless of other rules and thereby be led some distance further into spiritual science. A particular effort must be made to cultivate the quality of patience. Every symptom of impatience produces a paralyzing, even a destructive effect on the higher faculties that slumber in us. We must not expect an immeasurable view into the higher worlds from one day to the next, for we should assuredly be disappointed. Contentment with the smallest fragment attained, repose and tranquility must more and more take possession of the soul. It is quite understandable that the student should await results with impatience, but he will achieve nothing so long as he fails to master this impatience. Nor is it of any use to combat this impatience merely in the ordinary sense, for it will become only that much stronger. We overlook it in self-deception while it plants itself all the more firmly in the depths of the soul. It is only when we ever and again surrender ourselves to a certain definite thought, making it absolutely our own, that any result can be attained. This thought is as follows. I must certainly do everything I can for the training and development of my soul and spirit, but I shall wait patiently until higher powers shall have found me worthy of definite enlightenment. End of thought. If this thought becomes so powerful in the student that it grows into an actual feature of his character, he is treading the right path. This feature soon sets its mark on his exterior. The gaze of his eye becomes steady, the movement of his body becomes sure, his decisions definite, and all that goes under the name of nervousness gradually disappears. Rules that appear trifling and insignificant must be taken into account. For example, supposing someone affronts us. Before our training, we should have directed our resentment against the offender. A wave of anger would have surged up within us. In a similar case, however, the thought is immediately present in the mind of the student that such an affront makes no difference to his intrinsic worth, and he does whatever must be done to meet the affront with calm and composure, and not in a spirit of anger. Of course, it is not a case of simply accepting every affront, but of acting with the same calm composure when dealing with an affront against our own person, as we would if the affront were directed against another person in whose favor we had the right to intervene. It must always be remembered that this training is not carried out in crude outward processes, but in subtle, silent alterations in the life of thought and feeling. Patience has the effect of attraction, impatience the effect of repulsion on the treasures of higher knowledge. In the higher regions of existence, nothing can be attained by haste and unrest. Above all things, desire and craving must be silenced, for these are qualities of the soul before which all higher knowledge shyly withdraws. However precious this knowledge is accounted, the student must not crave it if he wishes to attain it. If he wishes to have it for his own sake, he will never attain it. This requires him to be honest with himself in his innermost soul. He must in no case be under any illusion concerning his own self. With a feeling of inner truth, he must look his own faults, weaknesses, and unfitness full in the face. The moment he tries to excuse to himself any one of his weaknesses, he has placed a stone in his way on the path which is to lead him upward. Such obstacles can only be removed by self-enlightenment. There is only one way to get rid of faults and failings, and that is by a clear recognition of them. Everything slumbers in the human soul and can be awakened. A person can even improve his intellect and reason if he quietly and calmly makes it clear to himself why he is weak in this respect. Such self-knowledge is, of course, difficult, for the temptation to self-deception is immeasurably great. Anyone making a habit of being truthful with himself opens the portal leading to a deeper insight. All curiosity must fall away from the student. He must rid himself as much as possible of the habit of asking questions merely for the sake of gratifying a selfish thirst for knowledge. He must only ask when knowledge can serve to perfect his own being in the service of evolution. Nevertheless, his delight in knowledge and his devotion to it should in no way be hampered. He should listen devoutly to all that contributes to such an end, and should seek every opportunity for such devotional attention. Special attention must be paid in esoteric training to the education of the life of desires. This does not mean that we are to become free of desire, for if we are to attain something, we must also desire it, and desire will always tend to fulfillment if backed by a particular force. This force is derived from a right knowledge. Do not desire at all until you know what is right in any one sphere. That is one of the golden rules for the student. The wise man first ascertains the laws of the world, and then his desires become powers which realize themselves. The following example brings this out clearly. There are certainly many people who would like to learn from their own observation something about their life before birth. Such a desire is altogether useless and leads to no result, so long as the person in question has not acquired a knowledge of the laws that govern the nature of the eternal. A knowledge of these laws in their subtlest and most intimate character through the study of spiritual science. But if, having really acquired this knowledge, he wishes to proceed further, his desire, now ennobled and purified, will enable him to do so. It is also no use saying, I particularly wish to examine my previous life, and shall study only for this purpose. We must rather be capable of abandoning this desire, of eliminating it altogether, and of studying it first with no such intention. We should cultivate a feeling of joy and devotion for what we learn, with no thought of the above end in view. We should learn to cherish and foster a particular desire in such a way that it brings with it its own fulfillment. If we become angered, vexed, or annoyed, we erect a wall around ourselves and the soul world, and the forces which are to develop the eyes of the soul cannot approach. For instance, if a person angers me, he sends forth a psychic current into the soul world. I cannot see this current as long as I am myself capable of anger. My own anger conceals it from me. We must not, however, suppose that when we are free from anger we shall immediately have a psychic or astral vision. For this purpose, an organ of vision must have been developed in the soul. The beginnings of such an organ are latent in every human being, but remain ineffective as long as he is capable of anger. Yet this organ is not immediately present the moment anger has been combated to a small extent. We must rather persevere in this combating of anger and proceed patiently on our way. Then, some day we shall find that this eye of the soul has become developed. Of course, anger is not the only failing to be combated for the attainment of this end. Many grow impatient or skeptical because they have for years combated certain qualities, and yet clairvoyance has not ensued. In that case, they have just trained some qualities and allowed others to run riot. The gift of clairvoyance only manifests itself when all those qualities which stunt the growth of the latent faculties are suppressed. Undoubtedly, the beginnings of such seeing and hearing may appear at an earlier period, but these are only young and tender shoots, which are subjected to all possible error, and which, if not carefully tended and guarded, may quickly die. Other qualities which, like anger and vexation, have to be combated are timidity, superstition, prejudice, vanity and ambition, curiosity, the mania for imparting information, and the making of distinctions in human beings according to the outward characteristics of rank, sex, race, and so forth. In our time it is difficult for people to understand how the combating of such qualities can have anything to do with the heightening of the faculty of cognition. But every spiritual scientist knows that much more depends upon such matters than upon the increase of intelligence and the employment of artificial exercises. Especially can misunderstanding arise if we believe that we must become foolhardy in order to be fearless, that we must close our eyes to the differences between people because we must combat the prejudices of rank, race, and so forth. Rather, is it true that a correct estimate of all things is to be attained only when we are no longer entangled in prejudice? Even in the ordinary sense, it is true that the fear of some phenomenon prevents us from estimating it rightly, that a racial prejudice prevents us from seeing into a man's soul. It is this ordinary sense that the student must develop in all its delicacy and subtlety. Every word spoken without having been thoroughly purged in thought is a stone thrown in the way of esoteric training. And here something must be considered which can only be explained by giving an example. If anything be said to which we must reply, we must be careful to consider the speaker's opinion, feeling, and even his prejudice, rather than what we ourselves have to say at the moment on the subject under discussion. In this example, a refined quality of tact is indicated, to the cultivation of which the student must devote his care. He must learn to judge what importance it may have for the other person if he opposes the latter's opinion with his own. This does not mean that he must withhold his opinion. There can be no question of that. But he must listen to the speaker as carefully and as attentively as he possibly can, and let his reply derive its form from what he has just heard. In such cases, one particular thought recurs ever and again to the student, and he is treading the right path if this thought lives with him to the extent of becoming a trait of his character. This thought is as follows. The importance lies not in the difference of our opinions, but in his discovering through his own effort what is right if I contribute something toward it. End of thought. Thoughts of this and of a similar nature cause the character and the behavior of the student to be permeated with a quality of gentleness, which is one of the chief means used in all esoteric training. Harshness scares away the soul pictures that should open the eye of the soul. Gentleness clears the obstacles away and unseals the inner organs. Along with gentleness, another quality will presently be developed in the soul of the student, that of quietly paying attention to all the subtleties in the soul life of his environment, while reducing to absolute silence any activity within his own soul. The soul life of his environment will impress itself on him in such a way that his own soul will grow, and as it grows, become regular in its structure, as a plant expanding in the sunlight. Gentleness and patient reserve open the soul to the soul world, and the spirit to the spirit world. Persevere in silent inner seclusion. Close the senses to all that they brought you before your training. Reduce to absolute immobility all the thoughts which, according to your previous habits, surged within you. Become quite still and silent within. Wait in patience, and then the higher worlds will begin to fashion and perfect the organs of sight and hearing in your soul and spirit. Do not expect immediately to see and hear in the world of soul and spirit, for all that you are doing does but contribute to the development of your higher senses, and you will only be able to hear with soul and spirit when you possess these higher senses. Having persevered for a time in silent inner seclusion, go about your customary daily affairs, imprinting deeply upon your mind this thought, quote, "Some day, when I have grown sufficiently, I shall attain that which I am destined to attain." unquote, and make no attempt to attract forcefully any of these higher powers to yourself. Every student receives these instructions at the outset. By observing them, he perfects himself. If he neglects them, all his labor is in vain. But they are only difficult of achievement for the impatient and the unpersevering. No other obstacles exist save those which we ourselves place in our own path, and which can be avoided by all who really will. This point must be continually emphasized, because many people form an altogether wrong conception of the difficulties that beset the path to higher knowledge. It is easier, in a certain sense, to accomplish the first steps along this path than to get the better of the commonest everyday difficulties without this training. Apart from this, only such things are here imparted as are attended by no danger whatsoever to the health of soul and body. There are other ways which lead more quickly to the goal, but what is here explained has nothing to do with them, because they have certain effects which no experienced spiritual scientist considers desirable. Since fragmentary information concerning these ways is continually finding its way into publicity, express warning must be given against entering upon them. For reasons which only the initiated can understand, these ways can never be made public in their true form. The fragments appearing here and there can never lead to profitable results, but may easily undermine health, happiness, and peace of mind. It would be far better for people to avoid having anything to do with such things than to risk entrusting themselves to wholly dark forces, of whose nature and origin they can know nothing. Something may here be said concerning the environment in which this training should be undertaken, for this is not without some importance. And yet the case differs for almost every person. Anyone practicing in an environment filled only with self-seeking interests, as for example the modern struggle for existence, must be conscious of the fact that these interests are not without their effect on the development of his spiritual organs. It is true that the inner laws of these organs are so powerful that this influence cannot be fatally injurious. Just as a lily can never grow into a thistle, however inappropriate its environment, so too the eye of the soul can never grow to anything but its destined shape, even though it be subjected to the self-seeking interests of modern cities. But under all circumstances, it is well if the student seeks now and again his environment in the restful peace, the inner dignity and sweetness of nature. Especially fortunate is the student who can carry out his esoteric training, surrounded by the green world of plants, or among the sunny hills, where nature weaves her web of sweet simplicity. This environment develops the inner organs in a harmony which can never ensue in a modern city. More favorably situated than the townsman is the person who, during his childhood at least, had been able to breathe the fragrance of pines, to gaze on snowy peaks and observe the silent activity of woodland creatures and insects. Yet no city dweller should fail to give to the organs of his soul and spirit, as they develop, the nurture that comes from the inspired teachings of spiritual research. If our eyes cannot follow the woods in their mantle of green every spring, day by day, we should instead open our soul to the glorious teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, or of St. John's Gospel, or of St. Thomas a Kempis, and to the descriptions resulting from spiritual science. There are many ways to the summit of insight, but much depends on the right choice. The spiritually experienced could say much concerning these paths, much that might seem strange to the uninitiated. Someone, for instance, might be very far advanced on the path. He might be standing, so to speak, at the very entrance of sight and hearing with soul and spirit. He is then fortunate enough to make a journey over the calm or maybe tempestuous ocean, and a veil falls away from the eyes of his soul. Suddenly he becomes a seer. Another is also so far advanced that this veil only needs to be loosened. This occurs through some stroke of destiny. On another, this stroke might well have had the effect of paralyzing his powers and undermining his energy. For the esoteric student, it becomes the occasion of his enlightenment. A third perseveres patiently for years without any marked result. Suddenly, while silently seated in his quiet chamber, spiritual light envelops him. The walls disappear, become transparent for his soul, and a new world expands before his eyes that have become seeing, or resounds in his ears that have become spiritually hearing. That is the end of chapter 3. I will begin chapter 4. I'm on page 114 of the book. The title of it is The Conditions of Esoteric Training. The conditions attached to esoteric training are not arbitrary. They are the natural outcome of esoteric knowledge. Just as no one can become a painter who refuses to handle a paintbrush, so too no one can receive esoteric training who is unwilling to meet the demands considered necessary by the teacher. In the main, the latter can give nothing but advice, and everything he says should be accepted in this sense. He has already passed through the preparatory stages leading to a knowledge of the higher worlds, and knows from experience what is necessary. It depends entirely upon the free will of each individual human being whether or not he chooses to tread the same path. To insist on being admitted to esoteric training without fulfilling the conditions would be equivalent to saying, quote, "Teach me how to paint, but do not ask me to handle a paintbrush." Unquote. The teacher can never offer anything unless the recipient comes forward to meet him of his own free will. But it must be emphasized that a general desire for higher knowledge is not sufficient. This desire will, of course, be felt by many, but nothing can be achieved by it alone, so long as the special conditions attached to esoteric training are not accepted. This point should be considered by those who complain that the training is difficult. Failure or unwillingness to fulfill these strict conditions must entail the abandonment of esoteric training for the time being. It is true, the conditions are strict, yet they are not harsh, since their fulfillment not only should be, but indeed must be, a voluntary action. If this fact be overlooked, esoteric training can easily appear in the light of a coercion of the soul or the conscience, for the training is based on the development of the inner life, and the teacher must necessarily give advice concerning this inner life. But there is no question of compulsion when a demand is met out of free choice. To ask of the teacher, quote, "Give me your higher knowledge, but leave me my customary emotions, feelings, and thoughts," unquote, would be an impossible demand. In this case, the gratification of curiosity and desire for knowledge would be the only motive. When pursued in such a spirit, however, higher knowledge can never be attained. Let us now consider in turn the conditions imposed on the student. It should be emphasized that the complete fulfillment of any one of these conditions is not insisted upon, but only the corresponding effort. No one can wholly fulfill them, but everyone can start on the path toward them. It is the effort of will that matters, and the ready disposition to enter upon this path. Number one. The first condition is that the student should pay heed to the advancement of bodily and spiritual health. Of course, health does not depend in the first instance upon the individual, but the effort to improve in this respect lies within the scope of all. Sound knowledge can alone proceed from sound human beings. The unhealthy are not rejected, but it is demanded of the student that he should have the will to lead a healthy life. In this respect, he must attain the greatest possible independence. The good counsels of others, freely bestowed though generally unsought, are as a rule superfluous. Each must endeavor to take care of himself. From the physical aspect, it will be more a question of warding off harmful influences than of anything else. In fulfilling our duties, we must often do things that are detrimental to our health. We must decide at the right moment to place duty higher than the care of our health. But just think how much can be avoided with a little goodwill. Duty must in many cases stand higher than health, often even than life itself. But pleasure must never stand higher, as far as the student is concerned. For him, pleasure can only be a means to health and to life. And in this connection, we must above all be honest and truthful with ourselves. There is no use in leading an ascetic life when the underlying motive is the same in this case as in other enjoyments. Some may derive satisfaction from asceticism just as others can from wine-bibbing, but they must not imagine that this sort of asceticism will assist them in attaining higher knowledge. Many ascribe to their circumstances everything which apparently prevents them from making progress. They say they cannot develop themselves under their conditions of life. Now, many may find it desirable for other reasons to change their conditions of life, but no one need do so for the purpose of esoteric training. For the latter, a person need only do as much as possible, whatever his position, to further the health of body and soul. Every kind of work can serve the whole of humanity, and it is a surer sign of greatness of soul to perceive clearly how necessary for this whole is a petty, perhaps even an offensive employment, than to think, quote, "This work is not good enough for me. I am destined for something better," unquote. A special importance for the student is the striving for complete health of mind. An unhealthy life of thought and feeling will not fail to obstruct the path to higher knowledge. Clear, calm thinking, with stability of feeling and emotion, form here the basis of all work. Nothing should be further removed from the student than an inclination toward a fantastical, excitable life, towards nervousness, exaggeration, and fanaticism. He should acquire a healthy outlook on all circumstances of life. He should meet the demands of life with steady assurance, quietly letting all things make their impression on him and reveal their message. He should be at pains to do justice to life on every occasion. All one-sided and extravagant tendencies in his sentiments and criticisms should be avoided. Failing this, he would find his way merely into worlds of his own imagination instead of higher worlds. In place of truth, his own pet opinions would assert themselves. It is better for the student to be matter of fact than excitable and fantastic. Number two. The second condition is that the student should feel himself coordinated as a link in the whole of life. Much is included in the fulfillment of this condition, but each can only fulfill it in his own manner. If I am a teacher and my pupil does not fulfill my expectations, I must not direct my resentment against him, but against myself. I must feel myself as one with my pupil, to the extent of asking myself, quote, "Is my pupil's deficiency not the result of my own action?" unquote. Instead of directing my feelings against him, I shall rather reflect on my own attitude, so that the pupil may in the future be better able to satisfy my demands. Proceeding from such an attitude, a change will come over the student's whole way of thinking. This holds good in all things, great or small. Such an attitude of mind, for instance, alters the way I regard a criminal. I suspend my judgment and say to myself, quote, "I am, like him, only a human being. Through favorable circumstances, I received an education which perhaps alone saved me from a similar fate." Unquote. I may then also come to the conclusion that this human brother of mine would have become a different man had my teachers taken the same pains with him they took with me. I shall reflect on the fact that something was given to me which was withheld from him, that I enjoy my fortune precisely because it was denied him. And then I shall naturally come to think of myself as a link in the whole of humanity and a sharer in the responsibility for everything that occurs. This does not imply that such a thought should be immediately translated into external acts of agitation. It should be cherished in stillness within the soul. Then quite gradually it will set its mark on the outward demeanor of the student. In such matters, each can only begin by reforming himself. It is of no avail, in the sense of the foregoing thoughts, to make general demands on the whole of humanity. It is easy to decide what men ought to be. But the student works in the depths, not on the surface. It would therefore be quite wrong to relate the demand here indicated with any external, least of all political demands. With such matters, this training can have nothing to do. Political agitators know as a rule what to demand of other people, but they say little of demands on themselves. Number three. This brings us to the third condition. The student must work his way upward to the realization that his thoughts and feelings are as important for the world as his actions. It must be realized that it is equally injurious to hate a fellow being as to strike him. The realization will then follow that by perfecting ourselves, we accomplish something not only for ourselves, but for the whole world. The world derives equal benefit from our untainted feelings and thoughts as from our good demeanor. And as long as we cannot believe in this cosmic importance of our inner life, we are unfit for the path that is here described. We are only filled with the right faith in the significance of our inner self, of our soul, when we work at it as though it were at least as real as all external things. We must admit that our every feeling produces an effect just as does every action of our hand. Number four, these words already express the fourth condition. To acquire the conviction that the real being of man does not lie in his exterior but in his interior. Anyone regarding himself as a product of the outer world, as a result of the physical world, cannot succeed in this esoteric training. For the feeling that we are beings of soul and spirit forms its very basis. The acquisition of this feeling renders the student fit to distinguish between inner duty and outward success. He learns that the one cannot be directly measured by the other. He must find the proper mean between what is indicated by external conditions and what he recognizes as the right conduct for himself. He should not force upon his environment anything for which it can have no understanding, but also he must be quite free from the desire to do only what can be appreciated by those around him. The voice of his own soul, struggling honestly toward knowledge, must bring him the one and only recognition of the truths for which he stands. But he must learn as much as he possibly can from his environment, so as to discover what those around him need and what is good for them. In this way, he will develop within himself what is known in spiritual science as the spiritual balance. An open heart for the needs of the outer world lies on one of the scales, and inner fortitude and unfaltering endurance on the other. Number five, this brings us to the fifth condition, steadfastness in carrying out a resolution. Nothing should induce the student to deviate from a resolution he may have taken, save only the perception that he was in error. Every resolution is a force, and if this force does not produce an immediate effect at the point to which it was applied, it works nevertheless on in its own way. Success is only decisive when an action arises from desire. But all actions arising from desire are worthless in relation to the higher worlds. There, love for an action is alone the decisive factor. In this love, every impulse that impels the student to action should fulfill itself. Undismayed by failure, he will never grow weary of endeavoring repeatedly to translate some resolution into action. And in this way he reaches the stage of not waiting to see the outward effect of his actions, but of contenting himself with performing them. He will learn to sacrifice his actions, even his whole being, to the world, however the world may receive his sacrifice. Readiness for a sacrifice, for an offering such as this, must be shown by all who would pursue the path of esoteric training. Number six. A sixth condition is the development of a feeling of thankfulness for everything with which man is favored. We must realize that our existence is a gift from the entire universe. How much is needed to enable each one of us to receive and maintain his existence? How much do we not owe to nature and to our fellow human beings? Thoughts such as these must come naturally to all who seek esoteric training. For if the latter do not feel inclined to entertain them, they will be incapable of developing within themselves that all-embracing love which is necessary for the attainment of higher knowledge. Nothing can reveal itself to us which we do not love, and every revelation must fill us with thankfulness, for we ourselves are the richer for it. Number seven. All these conditions must be united in a seventh, to regard life unceasingly in the manner demanded by these conditions. The student thus makes it possible to give his life the stamp of uniformity. All his modes of expression will, in this way, be brought into harmony and no longer contradict each other. And thus he will prepare himself for the inner tranquility he must attain during the preliminary steps of his training. Anyone sincerely showing the goodwill to fulfill these conditions may decide to seek esoteric training. He will then be ready to follow the advice given above. Much of this advice may appear to be merely on the surface, and many will perhaps say that they did not expect the training to proceed in such strict forms. But everything interior must manifest itself in an exterior way, and just as a picture is not evident when it exists only in the mind of the painter, so too there can be no esoteric training without outward expression. Disregard for strict forms is only shown by those who do not know that the exterior is the avenue of expression for the interior. No doubt it is the spirit that really matters, and not the form. But just as form without spirit is null and void, so also would spirit remain inactive if it did not create for itself a form. The above conditions are calculated to render the student strong enough to fulfill the further demands made on him during his training. If he fail in these conditions, he will hesitate before each new demand, and without them, he will lack that faith in man which he must possess. For all striving for truth must be founded on faith in and true love for man. But though this is the foundation, it is not the source of all striving for truth. For such striving can only flow from the soul's own foundation head of strength. And the love of man must gradually widen to a love for all living creatures, yes, for all existence. Through failure to fulfill the condition here given, the student will lack the perfect love for everything that fashions and creates, and the inclination to refrain from all destruction as such. He must so train himself that not only in his actions, but also in his words, feelings, and thoughts, he will never destroy anything for the sake of destruction. His joy must be in growth and life, and he must only lend his hand to destruction when he is also able, through and by means of destruction, to promote new life. This does not mean that the student must simply look on while evil runs riot, but rather that he must seek even in evil that side through which he may transform it into good. He will then see more and more clearly that evil and imperfection may best be combated by the creation of the good and the perfect. The student knows that out of nothing, nothing can be created, but also that the imperfect can be transformed into the perfect. Anyone developing within himself the disposition to create will soon find himself capable of facing evil in the right way. It must be clearly realized that the purpose of this training is to build and not to destroy. The student should therefore bring with him the goodwill for sincere and devoted work, and not the intention to criticize and destroy. He should be capable of devotion, for he must learn what he does not yet know. He should look reverently on that which discloses itself. Work and devotion, these are the fundamental qualities which must be demanded of the student. Some come to realize that they are making no progress, though in their own opinion they are untiringly active. The reason is that they have not grasped the meaning of work and devotion in the right way. Work done for the sake of success will be the least successful, and learning pursued without devotion will be the least conducive to progress. Only the love of work and not of success leads to progress. And if in learning the student seeks straight thinking and sound judgment, he need not stunt his devotion by doubts and suspicions. We are not reduced to servile subjection in listening to some information with quiet devotion, and because we do not at once oppose it with our own opinion. Anyone having advanced some way in the attainment of higher knowledge knows that he owes everything to quiet attention and active reflection, and not to willful personal judgment. We should always bear in mind that we do not need to learn what we are already able to judge. Therefore, if our sole intention is to judge, we can learn nothing more. Esoteric training, however, centers in learning. We must have absolutely the goodwill to be learners. If we cannot understand something, it is far better not to judge than to judge adversely. We can wait until later for a true understanding. The higher we climb the ladder of knowledge, the more do we require the faculty of listening with quiet devotion. All perception of truth, all life and activity in the world of the spirit, becomes subtle and delicate in comparison with the processes of the ordinary intellect and of life in the physical world. The more the sphere of our activity widens out before us, the more delicate are the processes in which we are engaged. It is for this reason that men arrive at such different opinions and points of view regarding the higher regions. But there is one and only one opinion regarding higher truths, and this one opinion is within reach of all who through work and devotion have so risen that they can really behold truth and contemplate it. Opinions differing from the one true opinion can only be arrived at when people, insufficiently prepared, judge in accordance with their pet theories, their habitual ways of thought, and so forth. Just as there is only one correct opinion concerning a mathematical problem, so also is this true with regard to the higher worlds. But before such an opinion can be reached, due preparation must first be undergone. If this were only considered, the conditions attached to esoteric training would be surprising to none. It is indeed true that truth and the higher life abide in every soul, and that each can and must find them for himself. But they lie deeply buried and can only be brought up from their deep shafts after all obstacles have been cleared away. Only the experienced can advise how this may be done. Such advice is found in spiritual science. No truth is forced on anyone. No dogma is proclaimed. A way only is pointed out. It is true that everyone could find this way unaided, but only perhaps after many incarnations. By esoteric training, this way is shortened. We thus reach more quickly a point from which we can cooperate in those worlds where the salvation and evolution of man are furthered by spiritual work. This brings to an end the indications to be given in connection with the attainment of knowledge of the higher worlds. In the following chapter, and in further connection with the above, it will be shown how this development affects the higher elements of the human organism, the soul organism or astral body, and the spirit or thought body. In this way, the indications here given will be placed in a new light, and it will be possible to penetrate them in a deeper sense. That's the end of chapter 4. I am on page 130, beginning 131, the fifth chapter. And that will begin on the next tape. I believe that's going to be tape 3. In consequence of time, observation does in fact come before thinking. For even thinking, we must get to know first through observation. It was essentially a description of an observation when at the beginning of this chapter we gave an account of how thinking lights up in the presence of an event and goes beyond what is merely presented. Everything that enters the circle of our experience, we first become aware of through observation. The content of sensation, perception, and contemplation, all feelings, acts of will, dreams and fancies, mental pictures, concepts and ideas, all illusions and hallucinations are given to us through observation. But thinking as an object of observation differs essentially from all other objects. The observation of a table or a tree occurs in me as soon as these objects appear upon the horizon of my experience. Yet I do not, at the same time, observe my thinking about these things. I observe the table, and I carry out the thinking about the table. But I do not, at the same moment, observe this. I must first take up a standpoint outside my own activity. If, in addition to observing the table, I want also to observe my thinking about the table. Whereas observation of things and events and thinking about them are everyday occurrences filling up the continuous current of my life, observation of the thinking itself is a kind of exceptional state. This fact must be properly taken into account when we come to determine the relationship of thinking to all other contents of observation. We must be quite clear about the fact that in observing thinking, we are applying to it a procedure which constitutes the normal course of events for the study of the whole of the rest of the world content, but which, in this normal course of events, is not applied to thinking itself. Someone might object that what I have said about thinking applies equally to feeling and to all other spiritual activities. Thus, for instance, when I have a feeling of pleasure, the feeling is also kindled by the object, and it is this object that I observe, but not the feeling of pleasure. This objection, however, is based on an error. Pleasure does not stand at all in the same relation to its object as the concept formed by thinking. I am conscious in the most positive way that the concept of a thing is formed through my activity, whereas pleasure is produced in me by an object in the same way as, for instance, a change is caused in an object by a stone which falls on it. For observation, a pleasure is given in exactly the same way as the event which causes it. The same is not true of the concept. I can ask why a particular event arouses in me a feeling of pleasure, but I certainly cannot ask why an event produces in me a particular set of concepts. The question would be simply meaningless. In reflecting upon an event, I am in no way concerned with an effect upon myself. I can learn nothing about myself through knowing the concepts which correspond to the observed change in a pane of glass by a stone thrown against it. But I do very definitely learn something about my personality when I know the feeling which a certain event arouses in me. When I say of an observed object, quote, this is a rose,